It's Wednesday, January 19. Is that correct?
20.
January 20. All right. And I'm passing out a couple things, which is a handout dealing with the Calvin cycle, and also a belated handout dealing with chapter 19, the end of the PowerPoint problems, calculating the standard free energy of that simple problem. I show you two methods, and we'll go over that in just a little bit. As soon as the crowd, please don't rush. There's plenty of seats. No, sorry. You know, this kind of a popular class, the reputation of it builds, and people just keep coming more and more. You know, every day we get new students because they want to hang out with the cool people. At any rate, me, although I'm not that cool, by any means. My children would say I'm an old fuddy-duddy. You barely know how to text, Dad. What are you doing? Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you so much for the break we had. Thank you for the time we were able to catch up and get energized and rejuvenated. We ask now that you carry us through for this next month until we have another break, and we have a test or two in there, and some quizzes, and a little bit of homework in all our classes. And Lord, we need help with wisdom and understanding, and that we can use our talents well and control them, discipline them, so that we can find success in whatever our hands find to do. Thank you for keeping us healthy and whole, and help us to continue with that today. Help us to pass the love of God on to others through a smile, through comfort, through friendship, and through generosity, that we may be a part of the good things that are going on this campus. In Jesus' name, amen. All righty. Let's do the oldest thing first. And I'm not going to belabor the point because it's pretty much self-explanatory. At the end of chapter 19, you should see that you should have this handwritten out. At the end of chapter 19, there was a question about finding the standard free energy of a particular reaction, This is how it's done. It's really extremely simple. It's embarrassingly easy. There's a couple different ways of doing it. The first method is where you write the reaction in two half reactions. And when, for example, the succinate to fumarate, which is the way it's written there in the problem, when you look at the standard free energy table, the voltage value is, in fact, a positive. But When you write it out in the reaction form, and it's inverted from what the standard table form is, then you change the voltage. So the voltage on the table that you have given out to you is actually a positive 0.031, and I made it a negative, and I said note the reversed sign, and so then you total up those two half reactions, and you plug it into the delta G equation, and there's your answer. And method two is simply to rewrite it and then identify the electron donor and electron acceptor and then use the simple equation delta E is equal to electron acceptor minus electron donor. When you plug that in, you end up with the same voltage and therefore the same free energy change. The problem as it's written is not favorable because it's got a positive free energy. So, anyway, be prepared to be able to answer that question. I, of course, will give you the tables I'll give you the tables dealing with the different reactions and so on, so don't concern yourself about that. Last time we met, we got stuck. I did. Let me be perfectly frank. I got stuck on dealing with the Calvin cycle. And Having gotten stuck, I decided to abandon ship and come up with a more, a little easier thing to do. That chapter is chapter what? Chapter 21? Is it chapter 21?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Don't mean to be insistent. Is it chapter 9? Is it chapter 9? Anyway, all right. So you can see as we went through this. Oh, come on. As you can see here, come on. Where are we? Boom, 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 boom. There it is. The Calvin cycle is, this is the overhead for the Calvin cycle that I was struggling with. And one of the reasons why I was struggling with it is because it's hard to read, and they actually demonstrated how they get glucose out of this. And I don't particularly care how you get glucose out of it. What you have in your hand, and I don't know if you could, I'm going to turn the light back on because we need to just quickly go through this. This one that you have in your hand comes from a book called Voet and Voet. And to me, it's a little clearer about how things, because they don't go through the whole process of reforming the carbohydrate products into glucose. I mean, we can do that without too much trouble once we have captured the carbons. Once we've captured the carbons. So, the little key thing here is that the number of lines indicate the stoichiometry. So, looking at reaction number one that actually produces the ribulose bisphosphate called phosphoribulokinase, notice there are three arrows going in there. There's also three lines dealing with ATP, so which means that there are three ribulose 5-phosphates and three ATPs consumed, and you're making three ribulose bisphosphate molecules, three of them. Look in reaction number two. Now, in this diagram, reaction number two is the fundamental reaction of life here, I guess you could say. The ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. If you want to add in parenthetically under this particular diagram, you should say ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase, and in parentheses put in oxidase. And notice it's taking three ribuloses plus three how many carbon dioxides? Three carbon dioxides and making, notice, a total of six 3-glycerophosphates. All right? So if we add up the number of carbons here, how many carbons are there total in the ribulose bisphosphate? Ribulose 1,5-bisphosphate. How many total carbons? There are three molecules of how many carbons each? Five. So how many carbons are there coming into this? 15. Okay, we had three carbon dioxide, so theoretically we'd have how many total then carbons? 18. Those are encapsulated in six molecules of that 3-phosphoglycerate, 3-PBG, 3-PG. So now we have six molecules of that, 18 carbons. There's the phosphoglycerate kinase. Notice how many lines do you see there if you count it up carefully? You should see six lines, and 6 ATP produces 6-1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. Then 6 of those combines with 6 NADPHs to produce 6-glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate gaps. Now this is where this particular diagram simplifies from what's in the text, because what they do is, we now have a total of 18 carbons. Is that correct? 18 carbons. And notice we have 18 carbons and encapsulated in six lines or six molecules, six identical molecules. The one molecule, one of the six goes on to make what? Carbohydrate products. All right. One of the six goes on to that. I mean, so whatever that is, it goes on to make it. So you now have 5 molecules of 3 carbons each. So there's 15 atoms. But notice what they are. They're 5 of 3. Right? 5 of 3 carbons. And to begin the whole process, we need to make 3 of 5. So this whole rearranging process is designed to create, rearrange those 5 molecules of 3 carbons each into 3 molecules of 5 carbons each. Isn't that fantastic?
For you, I think it's completely ridiculous.
But at any rate, I mean, you can follow this around, and I don't know if we want to give it a shot or not. Let's see here. Transketolase. Boom, 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 boom. All right. So, what we're going to do here is, let's see. I actually have this written up here, and let's see if we can make sense out of it together. I don't really want to whack it this hard, but we kind of need to because it's cool chemistry. We need to see what's going on with it. Okay. So, theoretically at least, we now have... Oh, come on. Theoretically, we've got this. So, we've got 2 carbons coming in. Keep forgetting that word treats this thing as a different signal. We have 5 molecules of that 3 carbons. Let's see here. Two of the five come in and are altered by triphosphatidylsilanase to make DHAP. So how many molecules of DHAP do we have right here? Put 2 right here. Put 2. 2. Now, those 2, one of them comes in, and combines with number 3 of the ribose. And so we now have this fructose bisphosphate. Let's count them up. How many carbons here? 3 of them. How many of these 3 are there? 2. One of them gets shunted off over here. We'll see that in a little bit. One of them goes on here and combines with another 3 carbon. Where's that third carbon coming from? Well, that other set of 3 carbons is coming from the product here. So now you've got 3 carbons come from DHAP. 3 carbons coming in from the glyceraldehyde for a total then of 6 carbons, which makes fructose. That goes on to make fructose 6-phosphates. So there's fructose 6-phosphate, and we'll just hold it right there. How many carbons are sitting right here? 6. 6 carbons are coming from here. And so it's using up 2 of the 5 gaps, or whatever they call it. It's not gaps. Yeah, they call it gaps. 2 of the 5 gaps is right here. And now what's happened to the other dihydroxyacetone? Well, it comes over here. Let's follow this second. Let's follow it over here, and let's land right here. And where in the world did we get that erythrose 1-phosphate from? Where in the world did that come from? Well, let's see. Oh. Okay. Now, notice if you would here, ladies and gentlemen, this molecule here is a, how many carbon? 6. If you follow the line, we have another 3 coming in here, right? So how many carbons are here? I got a 6 and a 3 carbon. How many carbons is that? 9. Well, look what happens. That 9 can be rearranged to form a... How many carbons here? A 5. And that would mean how many carbons are left over? 4. So you get a... So this 3 and 6 right here turns into a 5 and a 4. And that 4 is up here. This is erythrose 4-phosphate. So you got a 4-carbon unit here. This 3-carbon unit is coming in. The DHAP is coming in. So you have a 4 and a 3. And that makes a how many carbon unit? 7. And that's called cetoheptulose. Hept. 7. Cetoheptulose. Then cetoheptulose, bisphosphate, one of the phosphates is lost. And you get this cetoheptulose 5-phosphate. Now comes the real, really, really cool trick. All right, we've used up 4 of the 5 products. We've used up 4 of the 5 products. So now we've got a 7. That 7 now combines with a... Notice where this is coming from. It combines with the 5th and last gap. That's gap, that's number 5 right here. So tell me, what's the total of a 7 and a 3? How many carbons? 10. We could break that up into 2 5s. And then the whole process starts all over again. Wow! Is that cool or what? It's complicated as all get out. Imagine you're an investigator in the 1960s trying to piece all this together with radioactivity. You're exposing your grad students to enough radioactivity to kill a horse to try to get all the radioactivity, get everything hot enough to measure. And you're trying to figure all this stuff out, and they finally do. Imagine to their surprise when they first find a carbohydrate that's got 7 carbons in it. Amazing. So, let's quickly review, shall we? How many gaps do we get after the oxidative, or actually it's called the reductive portion of the Calvin cycle? 6. One of them gets shunted off to be made into carbohydrate products. All right? If you keep doing this over and over and over again, you're going to have plenty of gap to be made into glucose. All right, so, but that leaves 5 to rearrange. 2 of the 5 get made into dihydroxyacetone phosphate. The other three remain as they are until they're used. Those two get made into dihydroxyacetone, combining with another gap to make fructose and fructose 6-phosphate, which holds up here. That other one comes over here and waits for this fructose 6-phosphate to combine with another gap to make a 9, which is split by this transketolase to make a 5 and a 4. The 4 and the 3 then combine to make a 7. The 7 then holds here until another 3 comes down to make a 10, which is then acted upon by... Is it that same transketolase? No, it's a different transketolase. This 3 and 7 is then combined and transformed by this transketolase to make 2 5s. And at the ultimate end, we have a total of 3 5s from 5 3s. And what is that called? Calvin cycle. Which of these cycles uses or consumes energy? Which part of this? Well, if you notice at the top, they put all the energy consumption reactions at the top line. This is like part one of the Calvin cycle. And everything below the line, below this horizontal visual line, is rearrangement of carbon atoms without any additional energy. Without any additional energy. You notice there's no ATP consumption, whatever. There's some phosphate breakage, which is an energy favorable thing. But all these carbon bonds are being broken and reformed without any additional energy. That particular enzyme right there, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase, the most important enzyme in the world. Most people wouldn't know it. You now know probably something. I mean, there's a lot of biologists that know this, but you are among the most highly trained young people in the United States. At this point, you are. And you'll continue to grow in wisdom and power. All right. Did we finish chapter 21? I don't think we did the last slide. The last slide is this thing here, isn't it? All right. Now, plants don't like. You don't have this handout? You do or you don't? Oh, okay. Plants are not happy with the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. As far as plants are concerned, the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is too low for plants to be. I mean, how else do you explain this C4 pathway for CO2 fixation? The C4 and the Krasulian acid metabolism is, just want to make sure here. Yeah, it's the Krasulian acid metabolism and this C4 pathway are two different ways of dealing with unique problems that plants face in certain environments. This particular C4 pathway is used by plants who want to gain a selective advantage by capturing more efficiently carbon dioxide to get a growth advantage. It's basically a CO2 delivery system which carries carbon dioxide from the oxygen-rich leaf surface to the interior cells where CO2 won't compete with the Rubisco reaction. Again, what does Rubisco stand for? Ribulose, bis, phosphate, carboxylase. That's the C. What does the O stand for? Oxidase. Okay, Rubisco. So because oxygen won't compete in the Rubisco reaction? What does that mean? It won't compete. You mean there's a problem with ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase? Is there a problem with it? Isn't it purely capturing only carbon dioxide? Or does it capture other gases in the atmosphere? If it does capture other gases in the atmosphere, what gas is it capturing? Oxygen, right. That sets up a futile cycle, which we will not get involved in, which actually releases already captured carbon dioxide. Not a good thing. So if the cell could increase the concentration of carbon dioxide and eliminate or reduce the amount of oxygen that it competes with the Rubisco reaction, you'll have a growth advantage. So the C4 pathway and the Krasulian acid metabolism pathway is that. You need to read this in your text. I'm not going to talk about it here. I expect you to have some understanding of this. The Krasulian acid metabolism deals with desert plants where they try to capture carbon dioxide during the day without having their pores open so water escapes. So this Krasulian acid metabolism is primarily with desert plants. Okay. Hatch slack pathway carbon dioxide uptake in C4 plants. So what happens is you got the mesophyll on the surface, but you've got these other cells that are actually doing the Calvin cycle away from the surface. So the mesophyll cell uses PEP and makes oxaloacetate. PEP and makes oxaloacetate. Wonder what enzyme that is. Let's see here. It's called PEP carboxylase, not surprisingly. So PEP carboxylase actually is another way of capturing carbon dioxide. It's not a net increase. It simply captures it to recycle it. So this is not photosynthesis. It's not a part of the dark cycle. Not part of the Calvin cycle. It captures carbon dioxide into oxaloacetate, which gets reduced to malate, which is then transported into the cell doing the dark reaction, where it's reformed as pyruvate, and release carbon dioxide right at the Rubisco enzyme that carbon dioxide then gets made into the glycerates and then gets made into glucose. And then that cycle occurs over and over again. Now, notice if you would, there's quite a bit of ATP used in this. Quite a bit of ATP. So what that means is the C4 plant is primarily a grass that grows in tropical regions. Grasses that grow in tropical regions, or grass-like plants that grow in tropical regions, because that means, since ATP is used to power this consumption of carbon dioxide, there's no particular great advantage for plants in which the sunlight is limited. Say up in the temperate zones or up near the poles where sunlight is limited. But near the equator, where sunlight is almost unlimited, you can make all kinds of ATP simply using the cycle for the PS1 cycle, the PS1 recycling cycle for electrons. You can make all the ATP you want. So you find this primarily in tropical plants. And if you would want one more thing. Most of the noxious weeds that gardeners and lawn care people think are noxious weeds have this C4 mechanism. Corn does. Corn is a C4 plant. Okay? Sugarcane is a C4 plant. Crabgrass is a C4 plant. It's a C4 plant. So it has a selective advantage to that. All right. Enough of that. Now then, do you have chapter... I will... chapter 20... this is chapter 21. Did I give you chapter 22? Is it available to you? Okay. Let's get started on that one right away, shall we? Did we start on this already? Don't think so. Okay. All right, well, this won't take too long. It's only 36 slides, and we've seen it all before. So it won't take too much. But you do have it available for you. Is that correct? Okay. All right. This is now chapter 22. What is gluconeogenesis and how it operates? Synthesis of new glucose from common metabolites. Humans consume 160 grams of glucose a day. 75% of that is in the brain. Body fluids only contain 20 grams of glucose. Glycogen stores yield about 180 to 200 grams of glucose. So the body must be able to make its own glucose in between feedings. In between feedings, especially if you miss a breakfast. If you have an early supper and then you miss breakfast, you are definitely operating on stored or newly created glucose. And your brain is completely dependent on it, on glucose. It can, given time, adapt to use ketone bodies, but, which we'll discuss in a little bit, we've got to go through fatty acid metabolism, but not quickly. If you remove a lot of the glucose from the blood, in a few minutes or even an hour or so, the brain cannot adapt and it'll starve to death. So how does the body make its own glucose? Oh my goodness, it's all sideways. And I apologize for that. And I don't know any other way of doing it. But let's take a look at the four enzymes. If you notice here, looking at your overhead, you see that the gluconeogenesis turns out to be exactly like glycolysis, except for four significant enzymes, four of them. So gluconeogenesis is the reverse of glycolysis, except for four enzymes. Let's go down here. Let's start at the bottom, okay, with pyruvate. We can take pyruvate and under the influence of pyruvate carboxylase make oxaloacetate. This enzyme right here, since it makes oxaloacetate, where do you find oxaloacetate as well in another famous cycle? What cycle is it? TCA cycle. This enzyme here is responsible for the anapleuretic reactions of the TCA cycle. What's anapleuretic? Filling up, right? Exactly. So, produces the oxaloacetate, and this enzyme is a multi-use. But if we're looking at gluconeogenesis, oxaloacetate then, under the influence of PEP carboxykinase, consumes ATP and makes phosphatidyl pyruvate, PEP, which, as you know, is the highest energy carbohydrate available in the body. That's why you get plenty of PEP. Man, I still think. I wonder how expensive it would be to buy that stuff. Put it in a bottle. We could sell it to all kinds of unsuspecting consumers. Okay, so PEP goes back to 2-phosphoglycerate, reverses to 3-phosphoglycerate, reverses, this is an amazing thing. This enzyme is reversible. It consumes ATP, makes 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate, reverses, consumes NADH, makes glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, two of those. One of them goes on the dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Blech. And so you get one of these and one of those. It makes fructose 1,6. Here's the other enzyme. This is a huge energy barrier to go backwards, so they avoid it. It's not reversible. It uses a new enzyme. Fructose 1,6 bisphosphatase cleave off that phosphate to make glucose 6-phosphate. Mutates this back to glucose 6-phosphate. And then to make actual glucose, you got to use glucose 6-phosphatase to make glucose. Now, again, this enzyme here is missing in the muscle. This is missing in the muscle. So that's why muscles do not participate in gluconeogenesis. To pump glucose units back into the blood, the liver is primarily the carbohydrate buffer in the body. Okay. Pyruvate, lactate, glycerol, amino acids, and all TCA intermediates can be utilized. Fatty acids cannot. Why? Most fatty acids, when they are broken down by beta oxidation, yield only acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA through the TCA cycle cannot provide for net synthesis of sugars. In other words, that the molecules that you see listed here are all 3-carbon or greater. 3-carbon or greater. 3-carbon or greater. Breakdown of fatty acids, typically by beta oxidation, only yields a 2-carbon unit. And that 2-carbon unit, when it enters into the citric acid cycle, is consumed and lost as carbon dioxide. There is an exception to this in certain types of living entities. Okay, what is the living entity that can take acetyl-CoA and make it into glucose? Can someone say seeds? Seeds take acetyl-CoA and make it into carbohydrate. What cycle, what pathway is that called that avoids the net loss of carbon dioxide, utilizing part of the TCA cycle to capture the 2-carbon acetyl-CoA units and capture them as carbohydrate units? Glyoxylate cycle. That's exactly correct. So 2-acetyl-CoAs come in and are manipulated through a couple different processes and make oxaloacetate. And once you make oxaloacetate, of course, once you make oxaloacetate, you can make all the glucose you want. All right, so that is that. Gluconeogenesis 1 occurs mainly in the liver and kidneys. What must be filled in there? It looks like liver and kidneys has to be filled in there. Okay. Now, this is available online, or I emailed it to you, didn't I? Did I email it to everybody? I think I did. Okay. Not mere reversal glycolysis for two reasons. Energetics must change to make gluconeogenesis favorable, and reciprocal regulation of gluconeogenesis must mean that one is turned on and the other is turned off. This requires something new. In other words, that you can't have both cycles because gluconeogenesis and glycolysis both occur in the cytosol. So you got a situation here where it's very difficult to have both glycolysis and gluconeogenesis occurring at the same time, but you'd have the classic futile cycle. Classic futile cycle. So it's got to be reciprocal regulation. One's got to be turned on, the other's got to be turned off. All right. So this, again, is just a review of what we just went over. Something borrowed from glycolysis, something new. Those are the four enzymes. Okay. Now, you need to be able to recall the four enzymes. Am I going to ask you to regurgitate the glycolysis pathway? No. Have you been exposed to the four enzymes of gluconeogenesis before? Yeah, in that little metabolic pathway quiz. I want you to review that. All right, steps 1, 3, and 10, these are the regulated steps. Those are the ones that are avoided in gluconeogenesis. Here's pyruvate carboxylase. Details. Pyruvate carboxylase is converted to oxaloacetate, requires ATP and bicarbonate. When you think ATP and bicarbonate, you should think of biotin as a cofactor connected to the active site via lysine. Acetyl-CoA is an allosteric activator. The mechanism I don't show you is typical of biotin. When ATP or acetyl-CoA are high, pyruvate enters gluconeogenesis. So when there's plenty of energy, the body begins to build up its stores of energy, and that means it begins to stimulate fatty acid synthesis and also gluconeogenesis. So when you've got plenty of energy, you're building up carbohydrate in your liver. Note the conversion problem in mitochondria. I'm not certain exactly what they're talking about there. You can just cross that out unless I run across it a little later. Okay, here's a pyruvate carboxylase reaction. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this. You can skip this. But when circle the bicarbonate and ATP, circle the bicarbonate and ATP and think biotin. Think biotin. Think biotin. Circle the bicarbonate ATP, think biotin. Okay, so pyruvate carboxylase is a compartmentalized reaction. In other words, that it occurs within the mitochondria. Because oxaloacetate can be transported across the mitochondrial membrane, it must be reduced to malate, transported to oxidized back to oxaloacetate before nucleogenesis can occur. So this crazy enzyme, this one, pyruvate carboxylase, is in the mitochondria. The rest of these enzymes are in the cytosol. Let me repeat that. The pyruvate carboxylase is found in the mitochondria. The rest of the pathway, including the specific enzymes for gluconeogenesis, are in the cytosol. So it's got to be transported out. That's what this diagram says. Pyruvate comes in, gets modified to oxaloacetate. The oxaloacetate is related to malate. Malate's transported out. It's reoxidized to oxaloacetate and then goes on to gluconeogenesis. So the pyruvate to oxaloacetate, that pyruvate carboxylase reaction, the one I'm highlighting here with my laser pointer, that occurs only in the mitochondria. Okay, conversion of oxaloacetate to PEP. Lots of energy needed to drive this reaction. Energy is provided in two ways. Decarboxylation is a favorable reaction because you release a gas, which is a highly entropy favorable thing. GTP is hydrolyzed. As you can imagine, GTP is an ATP equivalent. And so there's lots of energy when you release that first of the three phosphates. All kinds of reasons for that. Here's the enzyme reaction. Doesn't matter. I don't care about this that much. You can skip it. Now, so fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase. This is the enzyme that's, this is the one of the enzymes near the top, near the beginning of glycolysis and near the end of gluconeogenesis. The loss of that phosphate is favorable. It's regulated. Citrate stimulates this. Fructose 2,6-bisphosphate inhibits. AMP inhibits. You need to know what's, how it's stimulated and how it's inhibited. Citrate stimulates. Now, does this make sense that citrate stimulates it? When do you have high levels of citrate? When there's plenty of energy or when there's a lack of energy? When would you have high levels of citrate? When there's high energy, when there's plenty of energy in the cell, or a lack of energy in the cell? No, unfortunately, when there's plenty of energy in the cell. Do you have chapter... chapter 19... Was chapter 19 the handout that was from in Word? I mean, it was a Word document? Was it 20? Do you have chapter 20 here? Okay. If you have chapter 20 here, I need for you to take a quick look at something for me. And I mean quick, we only have 6 minutes left. This isn't it? This is it. Okay. I want you to note something here. Page 3. Page 3. Other important shuttles. There is a citrate shuttle. At the top of page 3, you'll see citrate inside the mitochondria has a transport mechanism that brings citrate outside the mitochondria. Okay, so this occurs only when there's plenty of energy in the mitochondria. There's plenty of carbon equivalents that are floating around the mitochondria, plenty of fat coming in, maybe plenty of pyruvate coming in. So citrate stimulates the stimulates gluconeogenesis, which makes sense. If the cell is replete with energy, has plenty of energy, it is going to try to store some for the system, store some for the body. So it begins to stimulate fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, which is part of gluconeogenesis. So citrate stimulates a phosphatase, which increases the amount of glucose being produced. What's the fate of that glucose, do you think? It gets made into what? If you're storing energy and you're storing it as glucose polymer, what's the glucose polymer in your body? Glycogen. So these same liver cells that now have a lot of citrate in them are producing lots of glucose 6-phosphate, which gets shunted over to glucose to glycogen synthase and gets made into glycogen, and you get stored in that same cell where there's lots of citrate. Fructose 2,6-bisphosphate inhibits. I wish we probably need to go through that process again. It was one of the metabolic... Can you bring that... Does anybody here have their metabolic pathways with them? Okay. There's one entitled fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase, or regulation of glycolysis or whatever. It's one of the last ones. If I think about it, I'll mention it again on Friday. All right, and then AMP inhibits, which means that if there's high AMP inhibits, which means AMP is an indicator of a low of energy of the cell having a relatively low energy status. It needs energy when the high levels of AMP exist. So high levels of AMP inhibit the phosphatase, which means that gluconeogenesis is slowed down, emphasizing glycolysis, which would be the appropriate thing. We're going to skip this. That's just a chemical reaction. Glucose 6-phosphatase. So this reaction, fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, ultimately produces this glucose 6-phosphate. The presence of glucose 6-phosphate, phosphatase in ER, liver, and kidney cells make gluconeogenesis possible. Muscle and brain do not do gluconeogenesis. Glucose 6-phosphate is hydrolyzed, passes into the ER. ER vesicles filled with glucose, diffuse the plasma membrane, fuse with it open, releasing glucose into the bloodstream. This is how this is done in the endoplasmic reticulum of liver and kidney cells. So that's how the glucose is released into the blood from the liver and kidney cells through that. You can see a diagram here, glucose 6-phosphate hydrolyzes and produces this glucose, free glucose in the endoplasmic reticulum. The endoplasmic reticulum blebs off, moves through through Golgi apparatus to the surface of the cell and releases it there. All right. Lactate recycling. Right. Helps you during exercise. How many of you are doing exercises? Anybody here doing regular exercise? Excellent. What are you doing, Ken? Very nice. Very good. What are you doing? Kickboxing. Very nice. That's to keep all those men at a distance, huh? Never mind. At any rate, I'm doing a little bit of exercising myself, I may add. In the morning, I get up and do some stuff. Okay, and it's very invigorating first thing in the morning. Makes you feel, I don't think, empowered. If you can discipline yourself to get up and do a little exercise, you feel focused all day because you overcame that initial inertia of, I want to stay in bed so bad today. So bad. But I have a grid in which I put a mark of how many things I did over the week, and I've got a whole year's worth of blanks for doing these various exercises that I want, and I want to fill those things up. I don't want to have big blanks because a big blank is a failure. So I got up this morning just so I could put in 33. I do 33 push-ups, 33 pull-downs, and 33 deep knee bends. Three sets of 11. I'm getting better at it, so I can do more. I think the next time I exercise, I'm going to go up to 12. Three sets of 12. It's progress. It is progress. I was so out of shape, it was ridiculous. Recall that vigorous exercise leads to build up of lactate and NADH due to oxygen shortage and the need for more glycolysis. Does everybody understand that? Remember that? How we went through that in detail? NADH can be reoxidized due to reaction of pyruvate to lactate. So lactate can be thought of as a molecule that indicates an oxygen debt. Oxygen debt is this buildup of lactate. When you're running, you know, and you start feeling a little burning in your legs, in your lungs, and you get done and you're breathing like that. And you continue to have that higher level of breathing. You breathe deeper, you breathe more often after exercise, especially vigorous exercise. You're trying to take care of that excess lactate, the oxygen debt. The lactate that's built up in your blood is then in your muscle is dumped into the blood, returned to the liver, where it can be recycled to pyruvate, and then pyruvate can be reprocessed into new glucose. So the liver actually supports exercise by converting the lactate that you produce into glucose and getting dumped back into the bloodstream. Liver provides glucose to muscles for exercise and also to maintain carbohydrate for your brain. Then reprocesses lactate produced by strenuous exercise into new glucose. Now, this, oddly enough, has a name. This name is called the Cori cycle. C-O-R-I. Named after the guy, or I think it was actually a husband and wife, that discovered it. And it's the metabolic synergy between muscle and liver. Muscle and liver. We'll start down here. Here you've got glycolysis going on with vigorous exercise. You exceed your oxygen carrying capacity and you begin to build up lactate. That lactate gets dumped into the what? Blood. Which actually lowers the pH of the blood a little bit, is that right? If it lowers the pH of the blood a little bit, is that going to enhance or detract from oxygen transportation? That's for me to know and for you to remember. Okay? So, I'm going to ask you that question on Friday, if I can remember it. Dumping blood in, lactate in the blood lowers the concentration, lowers the pH a little bit in the blood. Is that an advantage for the delivery of oxygen or a disadvantage? Be that as it may, the lactate then travels to the liver where it's taken up, acted upon by lactate dehydrogenase, and made into pyruvate, and then pyruvate gets made into glucose, and the glucose gets dumped back into the blood where it's transported to the muscle tissue where it goes through that whole process again. Woo-hoo. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's been great. You guys have a great afternoon, great day. We'll see you again on Friday. I'll probably have a take-home quiz for you on Friday. Is that all right? Yeah, can you turn that in today? Please. I've got to turn off this.